RDX monitoring.
The 4RDX, K82BNG. I probably missed your call, messed up your call sign already.
Yeah, I wasn't ready to write either. I think it's KD2BNG, is that correct?
That's correct.
Whiskey Delta 4, Romeo Bravo X-ray. Name is Rich, Romeo India Charlie Hotel, and I'm in Townville, over.
You got it. Whiskey Delta 4, Romeo Bravo X-ray.
Rich.
I don't know if we've spoken before or not. So you're out and about today, and
in here in the shack. What's your name?
Glenn, Gulf Lima, Echo November.
Appreciate you coming back to me. I just got this ICOM 9700 in today. I'm kind of checking it out. And I'm just wondering what the audio sounds like. I haven't learned a whole lot about the radio. In fact, I'm putting out full power. Don't think I need that, but we'll go with that. What does it sound like to you? You don't know me. You don't know what I sound like. But what does this radio sound? Does it sound good?
There's a little bit of white noise in the background that I think is on everybody. That's coming out of the repeater. Right? But no, your audio sounds fine to me.
What matters? Because I really, like I said, just got it in, and all the audio settings inside the radio are set to like the middle of the road, if you will. And I know my other ICOM, seventy four ten, I had to go into the programming and change the highs and lows a little bit to make it sound right.
Good radio. I got two or three of them here. I got an ICOM IC718. One of these days, if I get up in on the roof and put up an antenna, I'll put back on the air. ICOMs are good. I've never gotten used to the weird. ICOM kind of is like, if you don't know the ergonomics, if you're not used to it. But they're good radios.
And everybody's got their own radios. Kenwood, Yaesu, ICOM, whatever. I've got a shack full of them. Let's see, I got five ICOMs and six ICOMs in here. One I'm giving away to a friend of mine. But I bought this one because I want to play with the satellites, and I think it's going to be a really good one to do that with. Now I've got to get antennas up. I'm nowhere near that point. I give up on UHF, VHF several years ago. And I'm just not getting back into it there, Glenn. Over.
A thing like that. A little tracking satellite mount for satellites. It'd be a neat thing to figure out how to build. I know you can buy them, but I'd like to actually design one.
Yeah, I don't know how good it would work. But I thought about the same thing, building my own tracker. The interface would be kind of tough, but I was thinking, how about linear actuators?
It is. Or stepper motors. I'd have to think about that as well. The mechanical part of it eludes me at the moment, but I'm sure I can come up with something.
No, I'm just throwing that idea out there. Just to give you something to think about. I don't know if they'll work or not. You get different strokes on the linear actuators, and they can be pretty accurate, because it's kind of like, a motorized threaded rod, if you will, that would move your antenna up, down, left, and right. I don't know, I don't have a problem with buying one of those Yaesu azimuth elevation rotors, especially the heavy duty, because one of these days I might even go for moon bounce. I don't know yet. This radio is a step in both directions, all directions, really. Terrestrial, satellite, maybe even moon bounce.
For Earth-orbiting, low-Earth-orbiting satellites, How you point it is not, you know, you don't need, it doesn't have to be that accurate. It's like you pump it in. How critical it is for moon bounce, I don't know. And I imagine there's a lot more power involved in it.
This is just the first step. I got the radio. And I was already told at 1296 by a real big moon bounce guy down here in Georgia that 1296 drifts too much for, with this radio, it drifts too much for digital moon bounce. But I'm not too worried about that. Years ago, I'm 64 years old, by the way. I played with satellites, I don't know, probably 25 years ago. I don't know how old you are, but I played around with the Russian satellites. 2 meters up, 10 meters down. I had a blast. And you're right. And of course, going forward beyond that, I set myself up with this crazy setup. I used two rotors, two regular terrestrial, rotors. One did the azimuth, the other one did the elevation. And you're right, it doesn't have to be that critical. Over.
A few degrees above the horizon. I got the satellite tracking program here somewhere.
Get you into the repeater. I probably am too. I don't know. It's probably just band conditions. I really don't know. I don't play with FM too much. But what I did years ago for the 2 meter uplink, I used the monoband 2 meter antennas at about 90 feet. And then when the satellite got high in the sky, I had a homemade turnstile for 2 meters. And it worked really good.
The Russian ham radio satellites, what it was that you said, two meters and 10 meters, and I didn't know there were any, right, or what orbits they're in.
Long gone. They're long gone. We're talking years and years ago. What I was talking was, using the 2 meter model band diamond antenna at 90 feet. When the satellite was low on the horizon to transmit to it, and then when it started getting high, like above 30 degrees or so, I switched over to a homemade turnstile, and that got me the overhead pass, or the higher pass, however which way you want to look at that. But no, it was 2 meters up and 10 meters down. You could actually hear the satellite before you could talk to it. Over.
Probably in some weird orbit, too, in some polar orbit or something.
No, it wasn't polar orbit. It was a high orbit. I mean, it stayed in view for a long time, like 15 minutes or so, maybe longer, 20. Can't really remember. But anyway, I don't know how good they are. You could buy those egg beaters. They're very expensive. You could build them yourself for much less than you'll ever pay for one. 432 up, 2 meters down, right-hand circular polarized. I don't know. I got a long way to go here. I've been out of touch with satellite work for a very long time. I know I keep saying over. I don't have to on a repeater. WD4RBX.
WDX KD2VNG. That's an old habit. No, yeah, there's a little beepy tone on the repeater. So you don't have to say over. I don't know. I'd have to start looking at that again. You know, my problem is maybe it's a function of, like, attention deficit disorder. I've got all these ideas for projects, and a lot of them get started. A lot of them even go almost to completion. But, I just, if I could focus on one thing and get it done.
Yeah, you're like me in a way. I'll start a lot of projects and, I need this part, I need that part, so it just sits there. And then I forget to order the part, and it just sits there. I'll tell you what, though, Glenn, if you're really interested in satellite work, you should look into the FM satellites. A lot of guys are working them with what they call an arrow antenna. It's a 2-meter, 70-centimeter antenna that you hold in your hand. And you use a walkie-talkie, and you talk to the FM satellites through your walkie-talkie.
I've seen videos of that. Somebody walking around with a handheld rig and, this steerable handheld antenna. I guess just sort of point at the satellite, you know, take your best guess as to where it is and how fast it's moving. As I said, you don't have to get that accurate. Within a couple of degrees, you're fine.
Especially if you don't go crazy and try to build you a long boom Yagi for a lot of gain, because then you really narrow down your beam width. I'll tell you how old I am. I actually talked to the Mir space station.
Oh, the Mir space station. Okay. That's been up there, well, it's not up there now. That was up there in the 80s and maybe early to mid-90s, maybe late 90s. There was a couple of your space stations. There was five or six of them. I
remember all how many there were. I talked to the International Space Station, that's for sure. They come booming in, by the way, you know, whenever they get on the radio. I don't know. I think they're still messing around a little bit, ham astronauts, if you will. I'm not sure what's going on there, but that's something I'll look into, too.
The Digipeter thing is on, I don't know the frequency offhand. There's a Digipeter thing, so when it goes overhead, you've got that. Whether there's 2-meter voice, I don't know. And what else, I don't know. I'd love to be able to figure out how to get those, how to intercept their TV feeds when they have the occasional video from there.
Difficult. If you got a good location, if you will, or a high antenna, just a regular terrestrial antenna like you're using right now, catch it on the horizon. I can't remember how long those image transmits. I really don't remember. But I've actually copied some of those pictures from the ISS. It's not that hard to do, Glenn. Just have a look into it. Get your satellite program going and know when they're actually transmitting the images.
The schedule of all these things, it's not, you know, it's not a secret. Yeah, Mir, I'm trying to remember. Mir, there was more than one Mir. Because they were low orbiting, they would occasionally fall into the atmosphere and go kablooey. And so there was, over the course of maybe from the 80s to 90s, late 90s, I think there was at least three or four of them. And I'm trying to remember, there was one or two astronauts who were like, one or two billionaire astronauts who paid like $20 million to go up there. One of them was the guy, from South Africa. The guy who owns the company that makes Linux, his name's Shuttleworth. He was one of the guys who paid $20 million to go up on Mir.
Musk, who owns SpaceX, which is getting ready to shoot up a rocket with astronauts on, I think, tomorrow. It's not Elon Musk you're thinking of, are you?
Elon Musk. Elon Musk, that's SpaceX. Yeah, they're launching something tomorrow from, I think, the old Cape Canaveral, the old Apollo launch site, somewhere around there.
Mentioned the Falcon 9 rocket with two astronauts on board going up to the ISS.
Scheduled to go up tomorrow.
Yep, WD4RBX. Yep, it sure is. They're going to have a live feed. I thought it was, I got two different times I saw on TV, 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon or 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. I'm not really sure which. I think it's on, what the heck channel is it on? Discovery or Science, maybe. It's one of those two channels. You can look it up on the internet and find out anyway.
Operational in low Earth orbit from 1986 to 2001, operated by the Soviet Union, later by Russia. I was under the impression there was more than one of them, though. Sometime in 2001, they deorbited it because it outlived its usefulness. But for a while, they were taking up, like, you know, billionaire tourists who could afford to pay, like, $20 million to go up there. I don't know if there was ever a lot of them. not too many people could afford it.
Yeah, if it was $20, I'd have gone. Yeah, that's not going to happen. I think ISS was doing the same thing. They're sending up people that could afford to go up there and spend a week in space. Can't remember how long ago that was. And I think they're flying on the Russian rockets, too. I'm not really sure. I might be wrong about Mir. I keep thinking about that. I'm not sure it was Mir or was the ISS. I'm thinking it was the ISS. I said Mir. But I think it was the ISS I talked 2 years ago.
Because ISS would have been much later. After 2001 or so, let me look up ISS. I'll tell you in a minute.
No, we can look it up on the internet and see if they had ham radio on the mirror. Stuff, Glenn.
But usually not things like this. I have the kind of brain that absorbs useless trivia, which is, good for engineering. You know, I'd remember details of projects that everybody else had forgotten. But other than that, it's just filling up your head with useless rubbish.
Yeah, my head's full of that. That just tickled me to death.
It's part of beer, because I guess it went up in stages. It says 20 November 1998. That might have been the first part, because it was built in, various Soyuz cargo modules. They just put them up there and put them together to build the thing over time.
Think about ham radio being on it?
The NASA might have that.
ISS, then. I'm pretty sure of that now. Because that was too far ago, too long ago. Because 1988 is when I moved down to where I'm at right now. And I was not into UHF, VHF back then. That's a lie. I was, too. No, I'm pretty sure it's the ISS that I talked to, because I'm sitting here thinking about it, and I used an FM radio. It was Simplex back then. I don't know what it is now, if it's anything. And, I mean, they're booming in here. It's just like, holy cow, there's the ISS. And I give them a call, they come right back to me. It's like, wow, cool.
It says it was after 1988, because that was when, I guess, the first module that they eventually assembled, that's when it first got up there. Oh, here we go. Amateur radio on the ISS is a volunteer program which encourages students to pursue careers in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Doesn't say any more about it.
Website dedicated to amateur radio on the ISS. I forget exactly what it's, how to find it on the internet, but you could probably just type in amateur radio on the ISS. And you'll probably come up with ISSAR or something like that. I can't remember.
His own website. But, let's see. Yeah, because this thing was put up over stages. The first module, Zarya, was launched in 1988 on a Russian Proton rocket. Another one, Zvezda, was launched into orbit. The first resident crew arrived in November 2000 on a Soyuz TM-31 capsule. And then there were other modules that were added on by a European Space Agency. So, there's like half a dozen countries involved in building it.
I wasn't sure whether someone was trying to use the repeater or not. We're kind of dominating it, but give them plenty of time to find out. Or for me to find out, or you to find out, and I didn't hear anything. So, yeah, the ISS was built in, modules were sent up there. Most of them were sent up there with the space shuttle.
Assembly resumed in 2006 with STS-115 Atlantis, which delivered the second set of solar panels. The expansion schedule was interrupted by the Columbia disaster in 2003. Expedition 1, which I think was the European, there was another module, arrived between the flights of STS-92 and 97. The two space shuttle flights each added segments. So, yeah, the space shuttle A bunch of Soyuz and space shuttle launches is what it looks like.
I think that the Russian space shuttle worked. Because if I remember correctly, they stole the plans from NASA, but NASA let them steal them because they were the wrong plans. Okay, I could be wrong. I don't know. I saw that on TV. I'm not sure that's absolutely correct. Hey, Glenn, I'll tell you, I'm really enjoying this, but I'm going to take a break. I'm going to go outside and have a cigarette. I don't smoke in my house. When you got, like, thousands of dollars worth of radio gear in here, you're not going to smoke anywhere near it. So I'll be back in a little while, if you're going to be around. KD4, IQ. No, that's wrong. That's Buddy. KD2, BNG. There you go. Glenn, we'll see you in a little bit. WD4RBX.
4RBX, KD2BNG. Yeah, I guess I'll be sitting here at my desk working on nothing. So, yeah, go have a smoke and we'll be back later.
2BNG, KA2TXJ.
KA2BNG, who was that? Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know if I got the call right or not, but I heard the 2 call sign there, and obviously you're not from the area. The handle, the name here is Jim, Juliet India Mike, KA2TXJ is the call, and I'm from New Jersey.
TXJ, is that what I got? No, I've been down here since 2012. I just haven't bothered to update the FCC database. I mean, it shouldn't really, you know, I could go in there and change it.
2 years now, and I updated the database with my address, but I don't intend to change the call. So, whereabouts in the 2 call area do you hail from?
I live near the 5 towns, Lawrence, Cedarhurst, that whole area there, which is just east of the airport on the South Shore in that area. And I had other, you know, relatives further down in Freeport.
Little, I guess, would be west of you, up in Jersey.
Okay, Jersey, what exit?
I knew you'd ask. That's what everybody asks when you're from New Jersey. Exit 11 off the turnpike, and 129 off the parkway.
Actually means little to me, but yeah, you're right. That's the standard joke. Oh, you're from Jersey? What exit?
He says that, and it is true. That's the central New Jersey Woodbridge area, actually just across the river from Staten Island, probably about an hour from the upper part of Long Island. And were you Suffolk or Nassau County down there? Where are you from?
Nassau County. In fact, go very much further west. You're in Queens. Right here, just to the, you know, just to the right of, or just west of JFK, or just, which I got my directions backwards, just east of JFK on the South Shore.
Okay, I've been down there a time or two when I was still working, but, and whereabouts are you up here now in the South Carolina area? I'm over in Taylor's.
Graycourt, which I guess is pretty much the same as Taylor's, and that not a whole lot else around here.
Okay. Are you new to this repeater, or have you been around a while?
Repeater a while. Maybe not as much as I have been. There is, of course, you know, Annette at 9 o'clock, you know, drop in there. I used to drop in there every night. Now, you know, less so.
Yeah, I check in there when I can. I joined the repeater, I guess, about a month ago, and actually, I only got the shack opened probably right about the time this virus stuff kicked in, right about early March. I was here for almost 16 months, I guess, before I actually put up an antenna and reinstalled a mobile rig at home to use. I do check into the net when I can at 9 o'clock. When things were really locked down here, you probably noticed, too, that the net was crazy busy. I mean, some nights they had 75 people checking in.
Still do. 30 or 40 40 is more common. I've seen nights when there was more than 50 check or more than 40 or 50 check-ins, and then that would go on till like maybe 11 o'clock at night. And then I've seen times during the year when it's like, okay, you check in at 9:20 or 9:30, then it's already over. So it depends on what mixture of people you got at the time, whether you got a good net going.
Yeah, that's true. But it is kind of fun to listen to. Sometimes I just sit there and look up the calls to see where people are from, and some of them are from the area.
A lot of people here, I'm assuming, from up north, the northeast. You know, whether it's for the slightly better climate or the somewhat lower cost of living or whatever it is, you know, a lot of retirees end up in this area. A lot of the retirees that used to end up, let's say, in Florida.
Yeah, well, that's my story. I retired as a state worker in New Jersey, and we moved down here in, like I said, just about two years ago. We moved down here on May 12th in 2018, so this is just past our two-year mark. And for the reasons you mentioned, cheaper cost of living, weather's definitely better, no snow, or very little, and taxes are a fraction of what they are in Jersey, and I'm sure what they are in Long Island as well. I know things are really expensive there, too.
Taxes on that house in Lawrence are probably north of $9,000, maybe closer to $10,000 for, you know, like a two-story house on, you know, your standard, what, maybe quarter acre, you know, plot of land, suburban plot of land. So, yeah, that's probably a lot that you pay in taxes.
I was paying just a little over 10 grand when I left, and for a standard, you know, suburban lot, which in Woodbridge, where I was from, it's not significantly different from Long Island in terms of the kinds of housing. In fact, it's very similar. You know, a typical 75 by, I think what we had, 75 by 95 lot. So my taxes are a quarter of that down here.
I guess your standard suburban whatever. So, yeah, Woodbridge, New Jersey, you know, Nassau County, Long Island, you know, probably very similar. And, you know, go a lot further down the island, go maybe way into Suffolk County, maybe it gets cheaper. You know, until you get to the very end where you got, like, the Hamptons, then it gets a lot more money again.
Yeah, it's crazy expensive down there at where all the rich people live, all the notables. But, company that I still work for the company part-time, but because of the virus, there hasn't been much work lately. But we do training, and I've done, in fact, our home office is, the East Coast office is in Long Island. So I've worked down there a fair amount, and it's very similar to Woodbridge, actually. You know, it's very same kind of, New York suburban location, nice properties. I owned a Cape in Woodbridge. There's a lot of similar style houses in Long Island in that area, too.
So the Five Towns area was more like working class. That was always a working class neighborhood. Not far from there, you've got some decidedly less working class neighborhoods. Where am I thinking of? Like Hewlett Harbor. You know, go there and drive around and look at how the real rich people live. You know, I would drive around a few times and, I'm running this battered up old car. I wonder if anyone's going to ask me to leave. If they asked me to leave, I would have said something flippant like, I'm looking for Jay Gatsby's place for the fish and shrimp soiree. Anyone know where he is?
Yeah. Well, they probably just figured you were the hired help dropping somebody off for work.
At that income level, we don't do anything ourselves. We have people for that.
It is nice there along the coast, those parts of, I guess it's the upper part of lower part of Nassau, upper part. I can never remember which. Is Nassau the first county or the second county? I can never remember which county comes first. The Queens area.
Nassau County, and then when you get out much past Shreveport or so, that's Suffolk County.
So there's some coast areas there in Nassau County that are very similar to the Jersey Shore as well. You know, some beaches and a lot of boating and some very good restaurants down around there. A few times that I've worked down there, I've eaten at a couple of them. Never a disappointment.
Shore of New Jersey looks very, very similar. So, yeah, very, very similar to the Jersey Shore. You'd be hard-pressed to really tell the difference.
This is the Jersey Shore, too. On weekends, you probably can't drive to the Long Island Shore like you can't drive to the New Jersey Shore, you know, the Parkway and the Turnpike or bumper to bumper. Not so much the Turnpike, oh, that's not the premium. That's not the premier way to get to the Jersey Shore, but certainly the Garden State Parkway. So what's that, the South Shore Expressway? Probably the same kind of move.
It's not over to Jersey very much, so I couldn't really tell you. Well, you know, like the Long Island Expressway or Sunrise Highway on the weekends are pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, the LIE, that's the one I was thinking of. Yeah, that's the one that takes you down there. Yeah, same situation. And it's the same kind of road, too. You know, low bridges and all that stuff. So are you retired down here as well, or are you still working?
Yeah, that's... I used to, you know, it's funny, you don't have to be out of the area very much to forget the geography. But... yeah, if I went up back there now, I could probably figure out how to drive again after wandering around for a while. But, you know, I forget all these things.
Righty. Yep, I hear you. So have you retired down here, or are you still working?
Retired, yeah, let's call it that. Okay, yeah, I got nothing to do all day. Which, in a way, is bad. I wish I was still working at something.
I got hired from the full-time job to continue with the part-time job, hoping that I could work, since it involves a lot of travel. But I had hoped I could work once a month, and it kind of worked out for the first year and a half. And this year, it's not been so good because of the virus, because nobody's traveling, and most of the people that we teach classes for don't want the classes because you can't put people in a classroom. So it doesn't look like the rest of this year there's going to be any work. So we'll have to see how that works out.
Zoom situation. Aren't they all doing that from home now? I mean, I can teleconference in a classroom just as easily. In fact, your job in a way might have gotten simpler. You don't have to go anywhere.
Well, the job entails teaching first responders how to use radiation detection equipment. So while you can give them some of the basics in a classroom setting, since we actually use real radiation for them to detect, you really have to, you miss a lot of the nuances of the operation without face-to-face training. So that's kind of the problem. And since most first responders are working crazy shifts because of this virus thing, and our target audience isn't available for the training, and the fact that you don't want to pile people into a classroom with using equipment that they're going to have to exchange between themselves, it does not lend itself well to remote training.
Yeah, that doesn't lend itself well at all to remote training. First responder, like firefighter training, you know, EMS training, that sort of thing, generally. Yeah, there's only so much of that you can teach in the classroom. You know, sooner or later you got to go out to the outdoor classroom where you can set a building on fire and say, there, go put out the fire.
Yeah, you can't teach them, proximity to smoke and fire too well remotely. And it's the same with the radiation detection. You know, you try to teach them how to read the instruments and employ the instruments in a way to be able to maximize their detection capability and that kind of stuff. And, you know, when you try to explain people that way, you know, and a lot of first responders, most first responders are hands-on learners, so since it's a little on the technical side, it's much better to put stuff in their hands. But hopefully, someday, we'll get back to that training. Since it's federally funded and supported, hopefully there'll be money left in the federal budget to continue to allow us to do it.
A lot of situations where you, well, it's specialized training, granted, but a lot of situations where you're looking for radioactive material, I mean, an industrial site or a hospital or maybe a nuclear power plant site or something, I mean, it doesn't very often come up where I'm trying to trace the source of radiation.
Well, there are transportation incidents that occur. There's a lot of radioactive material in transit over the highways. All of those circumstances that you mentioned are circumstances we train for as well, but our primary focus is in interdiction for potential use by terrorists.
About that, whether it's nuclear waste or whatever it is, sooner or later everything moves over the road. Oh, so you're trained, so you're mostly training to think, respond to things like a road accident. You know, truck flipped over, and now we're looking for, I don't know, whatever you're looking for.
But primarily we're focused on the Homeland Security side of the training to prevent people from being able to obtain radioactive material to use for some illegal or what we term nefarious purposes. So most of our training is focused on being able to detect radioactivity that might be on its way to become a WMD someplace.
Yeah, let me take the americium out of about 10,000 smoke detectors. Other than that, there aren't that many ways to legally get your hands on too many radioactive substances, I would imagine.
That's true. Since they're terrorists and they really don't care about legally obtaining this stuff, they will obtain it sometimes legally in quantities that can represent probably not a significant threat, but if they obtain it illegally, then that's primarily what our training focuses on, how to be able to detect that stuff and determine whether it represents a hazard or not, or a threat, which is, from a Homeland Security standpoint, would be the
reason. Man, you're starting to almost go under the noise. I'm trying to think of what else has, plumbers and carpenters and others used to use radioactive, I once had a plumber try to trace pipes. I don't know if he put something radioactive down the pipe, or maybe he put a little radio transmitter, but, there's all kinds of ways you're not going to prevent people from diverting things. I mean, you could try, but there's too many. It's like when Homeland Security was trying to figure out who was buying, diesel fuel and fertilizer. Well, I don't know, anybody on a farm.
Stuff actually tracked pretty closely now. There's a whole lot of ways to, what raises suspicion when you're buying that stuff together, I have to say. But from the radioactive side, when people obtain it illegally or are possessing it without appropriate documentation, that's, it's a big focus for law enforcement, for commercial vehicle, enforcement of the truck industry and that kind of stuff. And that's kind of what we teach people to be able to do.
And, I'm just trying to think of, there's always ways. I remember for a while, Homeland Security was even trying to cut the thing that I mentioned, who's buying up all a bunch of fertilizer, and who's buying up all this diesel fuel? Well, I don't know. Basically, every farmer in the Midwest. If you're trying to trace purchases of everything that could be used as a munition, then ultimately you're fighting a losing battle.
I could talk to you about some ways that other agencies go about doing that. I've been involved in a few of those investigations that have produced results. But anyway, I just have pulled into my driveway here, and it does get noisy down here. when I'm on the mobile. So it's nice chatting with you, and I'll be listening for you in the future. And I guess I'll say 73s for the moment, and talk to you the next time around. KA2TXJ.
You go about your business, have a nice day, take care, and we'll talk to you later. KA2TXJ, KD2VNG. 73s, I'll be clear.
Didn't catch the name again. I'm sorry.
Go Fleet and Echo November.
Okay, and Jim, Juliet, India Mike. Okay, Glenn. Nice chatting with you. I'll talk to you again sometime down the road.